Good afternoon to everyone. So, essentially, this focus lecture will continue from where we left it this morning with Mukund. And so, what we will see today is how you can actually compute observables, so here correlation functions, using holography or this dictionary that Mukund brought at the end of this lecture, and that we will review in a moment. So I've just listed here a number of references of things which are mostly relevant for this topic. So the first one is the paper of Witten from 98, in which he actually gave, formulated this field operated correspondence and how you can compute correlation functions. So the practical recipe for understanding ADCVC. Then I've listed also reference, a book, Di Francesco, Matteo and Seneca for conformal field theories. This is mainly for two-dimensional conformal field theories, but you might also get an introduction if you're not familiar with the subject. And then we will see that there is a whole systematic procedure which is very important in this context, and I will talk you through it, which is known as holographic renormalization. And this has mainly been formulated by Skenderis and collaborators. And here I've just mentioned one paper in which they give a detailed and comprehensive review of this method. And finally, there are now books also that discuss ADS-CFT. So there is a one which is a bit older from Kiritsis, which has some chapters on ADS-CFT. And there is another one from last year by Ammon and Ermenger, where you can find some of the things that we will present today, and also that Mukund discusses. Okay, so I would like to start with a recap of what you saw in the past days and this morning of the ingredients that we will actually need to compute correlation functions. So first of all, I would like to set the notation. So we will consider ADS spacetimes, anti-de Sitter spacetimes, in d plus one dimensions. And we will write a metric for ADS in Poincaré coordinates, which I believe we have seen in Veronica's lecture. So we will write the metric as in this way. And so here LADS is radius of ADS, which parametrizes the negative curvature of the spacetime, as Mukund introduced it this morning. And actually, for simplicity, as the computations that we will do are already quite involved, I will set the radius of ADS to 1 in the following. It just means that we will measure length in units of the ADS radius. So now, this Poincaré metric that you have seen, let me just remind you. So Z is a radial coordinate in the bulk. And so the boundary of ADS is at Z going to 0 in this coordinate. So that's the boundary of ADS. And in this coordinate, the boundary is flat. And we will work in Euclidean signature, because that's more suited for defining a generating functional and partition function and so on. And so in this coordinate and in Euclidean signature, the boundary of our spacetime is just the dimensional Euclidean flat space. Okay. Okay. So then the main ingredient that we will need is this field operator map. So it's this ADS-CFT operator field map, which is what Mukun introduced at the very end of this lecture. So the basic idea of the ADS-CFT correspondence is that to every gauge invariant operator O in the conformal field theory, or quantum field theory, which we can think of as being defined on the d-dimensional conformal boundary of ADS spacetime, we can associate, so this operator is dual, to a bulk field, let me call it phi, which is a propagating field in the ADS spacetime. So let me just make a drawing. So we can think of this d-dimensional boundary, which here I've denoted as a shortcut with just one coordinate, not to carry over the summations. So this will be the boundary of ADS, and where a local operators, these O, are defined. And while phi will be a field in a bulk, so here we can think of having an additional direction z, and phi of being some propagating field in the bulk. So since ADS is a spacetime which has a boundary, one needs to specify boundary condition for the field at z goes to zero. So phi is a dual field with fixed boundary conditions. And so in particular, we will need to specify what is the value of phi on the boundary. So so let me call it phi naught of x at z goes to zero. Okay, here I'm for the moment just hiding some things, but we will see it explicitly. I mean, what's the behavior of the fields near the boundary, and how you can actually specify boundary conditions. So there will actually be some conformal factors of the radial distance we enter in this expression. So then the idea is that what we can do, so if we look at the value of this field on the boundary, we can consider its boundary value phi naught as acting as a source for the dual operator O. And by what I mean by acting as a source, it means that we can consider in the conformal field theory a coupling between this boundary value of phi and its dual operator O. Okay. So that's the
boundary.
Yes. So now we'll make it precise. I mean, since you are stating an equivalence between two theories, so a D plus one dimensional theory of gravity and a D dimensional ordinary field theory, essentially what we are stating is an equivalence between the partition functions of the two theories. And so now I will elaborate a bit on that. Okay, so this is the formal field theory partition function, that is the generating functional of all correlators. So that's also what you saw this morning. So this you can write it as a path integral over all your fields of e to the minus. So we are in Euclidean, the action plus source terms for your operators. Okay, and then the idea, I mean, that's the standard thing. And so then the idea is that if you want to compute correlators in your conformal field theory, that is, I want to evaluate the correlator of N O insertions, for instance, I can just do it by taking functional derivatives of this generating functional with respect to the sources inserted at the operator's locations. So I can just take N functional derivatives with respect to phi naught of x1, phi naught of xn, and then set the sources to zero. Okay. So that's the left-hand side, which is the standard field theory or statistical mechanics side. On the other side, instead, we have so a partition function for a gravity theory. And here, by phi naught, I mean with specified boundary conditions for all my fields on the ADS boundary. So this would be the string theory partition function or the partition function of a UV completion of general relativity. So this partition function is not known so far. So the best that we can do for the moment is to actually evaluate this partition function in the corner of the parameter space, which Mukund referred to today. So here, so in the large n and large lambda limit, in which actually we can approximate this partition function by its a saddle point approximation, which only reduces to semi-classical gravity. So here, by this, I just mean a non-shell action of semi-classical gravity, which will have gravity and a few low-lying fields with specified boundary conditions for them.
What does non-shell action mean?
It means evaluated on a solution to the equation of motion. So that's exactly what we will compute. So the idea here is that so we can compute, if we put these two together now. We can just compute conformal field theory correlators by taking functional derivatives of this gravitational action with respect to the boundary conditions of our fields, and then setting the value of the fields on the boundary to zero. So that's the orographic prescription for computing correlators.
So this zero of gravity is the partition function for the field in the bulk. And what do you mean by writing it as like phi zero and then the ADS?
So here I just mean that since ADS is a boundary, for all my fields, I need to have a well-defined path integral. I need to give boundary conditions. So phi naught, it's a shortcut for saying that I have to write boundary conditions for all my fields on the boundary of the space-time.
Like, what is the source of this partition function in this case?
So phi naught will be, it's a collective name for all sources that I can have in my partition function.
So all the source is living on the boundary.
Yeah. So that's so these are sources for the dual operators O. So the coupling is of this type, right? So it's in d dimension. So d is the so this is the boundary space time, the RD. Okay. Okay, so this is actually what we will do now. So we will evaluate explicitly this gravitational action on shell as a function of the boundary condition for the fields, and we will take functional derivatives and check that it reproduces known correlators of conformal field theories. So first of all, let me just remind you what are these correlators in a conformal field theory. So you, well, I guess many of you know, and the other ones should have seen it in an exercise, that in a conformal field theory, the symmetries are enough to actually fix completely the form of two and three-point functions. And so I'm not going to go again through the derivation here. So let me just write a few things that we will need. So one, okay, the first one is the following. So one conformal transformation is a scale transformation in which we rescale our coordinates by a factor lambda. And so, so to be concrete, we will consider so scalar operators in the conformal field theory, which are dual to scalar fields in ADS, because that's the simplest case to start with. And so these operators O transform under a scale transformation as, so sorry, O of X is lambda to the minus delta O of X. And here delta is said to be the conformal dimension of the operator O. Okay.
Do you have some lambda in the argument of O?
No, so O of X will go to O prime of X prime, which is equal to a rescaling by this factor of Okay, so the form of two-point function is completely fixed, and that's you have computed in an exercise of Tom. So in particular for two, so these are called scalar primaries. So for two operators, O1 of X1, O2 in X2, this two-point function is non-zero only if the conformal dimensions of the two operators are equal. So if delta 1 is equal to delta 2, and in that case it's fixed up to a constant, which is just a normalization of the two-point function, which we can set to be a delta function, for instance, over a modulo of x1 minus x2 to the 2 delta 1. And it's zero otherwise. And so the form of a three-point function, it's similarly fixed. Let me just write it for completeness, but I don't think we will have the time to actually compute also that one. So this is fixed up to a constant, which depends on the three operators. And so, well, let me just use a short. This is x1, 2 to the delta 1 plus delta 2 minus delta 3, x1, 3 to the delta 1 plus delta 3 minus delta 2. and x 2, 3 to the delta 2 plus delta 3 minus delta 1. And here xij is just the modulo of xi minus xj.
Could I have multiple operators with the same scaling dimension?
Yes. It depends on your spectrum, on the spectrum of your theory. Yeah. Okay, so this is so two entry point functions are completely fixed by conformal invariance. This is not the case anymore for higher, four and higher point functions, because actually they can they will depend. I mean, they're severely constrained, but they depend on conformal invariance or cross ratios that you can actually construct with 4 points or more. Okay. So now the idea is to use holography, so this main entry of the holographic dictionary, to compute holographically this two-point function. Okay, so we would like to compute a two-point function of a scalar, primary O of x1, inserted x1 and x2. And so we will do this computation for simplicity in the vacuum of our theory. So O is an operator with conformal dimension delta. So through this field operator map, O corresponds to a scalar field phi in the bulk, in general a massive scalar field. And so here the idea, I mean, when we use this generating functional, is that what we are doing is actually a probe computation in the same sense that Mukund explained this morning. So what you do is you work in a fixed background and you turn on some fluctuations on this background, which do not back react on the geometry. You do your computation with the path integral and then you set them to zero. So that was just to say that in this limit, phi propagates into the vacuum of the theory, which is just empty ADS spacetime. So it doesn't back react on the geometry. So this just propagates in Euclidean ADS, and plus one, which is the metric we wrote at the beginning. Okay, so now we want to evaluate this two-point function. We need to evaluate the on-shell action for this S gravity. So it is enough since we will like to take. Yeah, so now we will just write the action, evaluate it, solve the equations of motion. So. Just a scalar field which has a mass, not a massless field. I mean, that's what I mean.
Sorry, what did the E stand for?
Euclidean. Oh. Can you open the door, actually, because it's super hot. Thanks. So in general, as this action will contain so gravity and all fields, scalar, gauge fields, and so on, which are coupled to gravity. But then what we would like to do then is to take functional derivatives only with respect to the boundary value of this field. And so since this field does not back react on the geometry, meaning it does not, we are neglecting its coupling and its reaction on the metric, it is enough for S gravity to just write the action of a scalar field in a fixed curve background. So essentially, the only part of S gravity on which we are interested in is the action for a scalar field, which I will take it for simplicity to be canonically normalized. And so in principle here, I could also have higher terms, self-interactions, interactions with other fields. But remember that what we want to do is actually to take two functional derivatives and then set the source to zero, so that actually it is enough to work at quadratic order in the field.
Excuse me?
Yes.
So is this massive field the field leave on the boundary and source of the gravity in the
Now, so this massive field lives in the bulk, in d plus one dimensions, and its boundary value, so what it reduces to, z goes to zero, sources the dual operator O, which I wrote above.
Sorry, what goes to zero?
At z goes to zero, we go to the boundary of ADS. On the boundary, the scalar field will take a specific value, and then it will couple to the dual operator.
And why does it have to be massive?
Because in general, for a generic conformal dimension delta, this will be a massive field. We will see in which case, for a specific choice of delta, the field will be massless, but it's otherwise generically massive. We will see the relation, if we arrive there.
Can you repeat the argument why we don't need to consider interactions?
Because what we would like to do then is to just take two functional derivatives with respect to the source and then set the source to zero. So once we have solved for the scalar field as a function of the source, so this will only be like some propagators times the source. So if we have three, let's say phis, it will be three sources. We derive two, and there is one that remains, and then we set it to zero. For 3 points correlators, you need up to cubic order.
What about?
So it becomes increasingly difficult as you go on.
So you're setting other fields also to zero?
No, not necessarily. I'm just saying that phi naught, so I will take functional derivatives with respect to phi naught, and phi naught will only enter in this part of the full gravity action. So this S gravity will include the metric and its Einstein-Imbert action, all other fields. I'm working in a probe limit, which means that I'm neglecting the effect of one field on the other, essentially. So this scalar field propagates in a fixed background.
Couldn't the other fields be part of the background for this?
So in general, if you work in the coupled system, the scalar field will back react on the metric, which means that the action of the metric will also depend on the phi naught, on the boundary value of the scalar field. But in the probe limit, this does not happen. So all the other part of the action does not depend on phi naught. So if you take functional derivatives, it just factorizes.
So can you remind that the probe limit is large n or large lambda?
Both. So it's large n and lambda much greater than one. So that's when you have a well-defined semi-classical holography gravity dual.
So the back reaction involves both 1 over n correction and 1 over
Yes. So n corrections are, hold on, I have to take it right. n corrections are loops, uh-huh. And the lambda is weakly versus strongly coupled. No, sorry, I said something stupid. N corrections are loops, so weakly or strongly coupled, right. And lambda just means that instead of gravity, I should take its UV completion. So higher string. Curvature corrections or string theory in the only realization we know.
Excuse
yes.
Me. Maybe I misunderstood, but about the interactions that we can consider, isn't the argument here that we just choose to consider the free theory? Because in general, the propagator of an interaction theory and of the free theory are different, right?
Right.
Right, so this is a probe limit. So our fields just propagates in a fixed background.
Sure, and our
which means
just
that
to be this, right? I mean, we
yes.
don't include any. In principle, we could include like cubic interactions.
Yeah, we can include them also now. I'm just saying that when I take two functional derivatives and then set the source to zero, it doesn't matter whether I included or not.
It will matter, right?
The two-point correlators of an interacting theory knows about the interaction.
Yeah.
Yes, at first order in the coupling, which of the interaction.
How do you mean? Oh,
is lambda the coupling of the interaction?
No. So here, I mean, I could have say, written, for instance, I don't know, xi phi cubed. So if you solve the equations of motion in the interacting theory, this will appear at order. So this will be a modification in the propagator at order xi.
I can see that if you take any term of psi which is higher than quadratic in psi, then this will disappear when you take the field psi to zero. But if you have something which is, say, quadratic in psi and involves some other field, why would this disappear? So if you have some term that is quadratic in psi and quadratic in some other field.
Yeah, I'm just neglecting interactions also with all other fields. Yeah. OK, but let's continue because it's really quite a long computation. So. OK, so from this one, we can compute the Euler-Lagrange equations. So this will give us the Klein-Gordon equation in ADS, which we can write as a box minus m squared phi. And let me write explicitly what box means here. This is 1 over square root g du mu square root g mu nu d nu phi. You can just evaluate it. Minus m square phi equal to 0. So square root of g in this coordinate is just z to the minus d plus 1. So you can plug it in, and what you get is z squared okay, and again here by x I mean all the d boundary coordinates. So that's like a sum of derivatives. So what we can do to solve this equation, we can Fourier transform in the boundary coordinates x. So we can write phi of z and x as a d-dimensional transform. Let me say phi tilde of z and q e to the I q dot x. And so now what does is just that we can plug it in, and then we can solve for each Fourier mode. So this just become tildes. And the second derivative just becomes minus q squared. Okay, it's not important, it's just to say, no, maybe that will. Okay. So now we can solve this equation for the Fourier modes. And the solutions are Bessel functions. So phi tilde of z and q can be written as a coefficient iq z to the d alpha and the modified Bessel k of nu q z plus another coefficient modified Bessel I of q and z. And here I've denoted by nu. The square root of d square over 4 plus m square, and by q, the square root of qi, qj, delta ij, which, since you're working in Euclidean signature, is a positive, non-negative number. Okay, so these are the solutions for the modes. We can look at how the solution behaves in the interior of the spacetime. So So like z goes to infinity, which is the interior of the bulk. So this Bessel function dies exponentially, while this other one grows exponentially at z going to infinity in Euclidean signature. So what this means is that for these modes, the field will blow up in the interior. And so it is not consistent at that point to actually neglect its back reaction on the geometry. So what we actually also want to impose is that our solution is regular in the interior, which means that we need to set all the modes B to be zero. So regularity in the interior imposes BQ equal to zero. And notice that this is the case only in Euclidean signature, because in Lorentzian, these two functions will be oscillating function in the interior, and one can actually take linear combinations of the two.
Sorry, so when we talk about ADS, usually we mean Lorentzian ADS, and now it is Euclidean, so I wonder why, I mean, how it comes into Euclidean here?
So the point is that the whole path integral formulation is generically stated in Euclidean signature, where it is more the better defined. You have e to the minus the action. And you can also redo the thing in Lorentzian. I'm just solving it in Euclidean because it's simpler. So as you see, I do not have to take linear combination of the two fields, of the two modes. I can only I can just set one of the two solutions to be zero.
So
it's just that in Lorentzian, it's more complicated to solve for these correlators.
From
the very beginning. So at the beginning, I say that we are going to work in Euclidean signature, where the boundary is just Rd, not Minkowski. Sorry? So nu is just the square root of d squared over 4 plus m squared. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You haven't talked about boundary conditions.
No, that's what I'm going to do.
So what does it mean to solve something without boundary conditions?
No. So I'm just looking. So there are two things. So you want your field to go at most to a constant in the bulk so that it doesn't back react. And you want it to satisfy specified boundary condition, which is the next step. So now we look at the behavior of the modes near zero, which is near the boundary. And so our solution will go as AQ to the Z, the D alpha minus nu. Okay? So you see, it's, well, let me translate it back into position space. So we can just, so these are a solution for the modes. We can superpose the modes, Fourier transform back. So this for the field phi in the coordinates zx just means, so these are the modes of my boundary condition, essentially. So it means that it will go to phi naught, but it also has a z-dependent factor. Okay? So now I would like to argue the following. So this is the behavior for a field near the boundary. So in order for this phi naught to consistently couple to a scalar, to a primary operator O of conformal dimension delta, the mass of this field has to take a precise value, which we now compute. So in particular, in the bulk, I can perform a change of coordinates. So I can go from the coordinate x, z, to the coordinate lambda x, lambda z. And the statement that my scalar field in the bulk is a scalar just means that it has to be invariant under this change of coordinate. Yes?
Well, I think I'm reading the symbols wrong. So d there, is that the number of dimensions?
D is the number of dimensions on the boundary, d plus 1 in the bulk.
Okay, and then that in U is d squared over 4 plus
m squared, okay. The mass squared of the field.
Oh, so dimensionally.
Yeah? Yes, because I set the ADS radius to 1 from the very beginning.
Okay.
So there will be m times L ADS
okay.
squared. Yeah.
So this is phi 0 z or x?
Yes.
It's x? I mean the argument?
X is the argument, yeah.
Like what is phi 0 again?
It's the boundary condition. It's the boundary value of my field. I'm sorry, but I really need to move on because otherwise... Well, I guess you should be a bit patient then, because otherwise you're not going to make it to the end, I'm afraid. Okay, so under this change of coordinates in the bulk, the scalar is invariant. So this means, if you can just check it, that phi naught of lambda x has to be equal to lambda to the nu minus d half, phi naught of x. Okay, but now from the boundary point of view, where I want to couple phi naught to an operator O of dimension delta, the transformation x goes to lambda x is a scale transformation under which my term, which I want to add to the action, must be invariant. So if you look at, if you remember, I canceled it. So O transforms with a factor of lambda to the minus delta. So from here, you get a lambda to the D. And so and from phi naught, you get a lambda to the nu minus d half. So what this means is that d minus delta has to be equal to d over 2 minus nu, which means minus d squared over 4 plus m squared, which means that the mass of the scalar field in the bulk is given by delta times delta minus 2. 2 in two dimension, in which I always work, here d. Okay. So you see that, let me just make a... so for... so when delta is larger than d, and these are... what are known, for those who know, irrelevant deformation of the theory. The scalar field has positive mass squared. For delta equal to d, that is marginal deformations, the scalar field is massless. And finally, for delta less than d, which is relevant deformations, so deformations that grow in the infrared, the scalar field has a negative mass square. And so you might worry that this is a problem. So in Minkowski, if you have a field which has a negative mass square, this leads to an instability, because it has an unstable potential. On the other end, in ADS, one can show, that's due to the negative curvature of the spacetime, that negative masses for the fields do not lead to an instability, provided they're not too negative. So in particular, for the scalar, we have a bound, which is called the Breiten-Lohner-Friedmann bound, so BF bound. And so ADS is stable. If the mass is larger or equal, then minus d squared over 4. And so you see from here that this corresponds to a delta equal to d alpha. So in particular, in Euclidean, you can consider operators which have a delta greater or equal than d over 2. And so, actually what we will do in the following, so we will neglect the equal case because that's a degenerate case. The solutions to the equations are not any, have logarithms inside and becomes more complicated. So we will just consider the strict greater inequality. Sorry? Now, scaling variance here, I meant the term that I want to add to the conformal. So the deformation that I want to add to the conformal field theory action has to be invariant under scale transformation. Yes. Okay, so I mean, we have solved for the Fourier modes. One can, in principle, superpose them, Fourier transform back, and that's, you can do it. It's just a bit long. So let me just introduce a formal propagator in position space by which we will can just solve the equation and just give you the result. So let me introduce what is known as a bulk to boundary propagator. That is an object K, which depends on a point Zx in the bulk and on a point X prime on the boundary. So this is defined to be a solution to the equations of motion in the bulk, and such as to that it approaches on the boundary a delta function up to a factor. So let me just write it. So this is a d-dimensional delta function on the boundary. And the factor is, so this is the limit as z goes to 0, that is the boundary of z to the delta minus d times k goes to a delta function. So then, if you're given such an object, then you can easily construct a solution for your field phi of x and z by integrating the x prime on the boundary, the propagator k against the source for the scalar field phi. So you can just check it quickly. So this will be a solution to the equation of motion, which satisfies the boundary conditions that we wrote before. Somewhere. So let me just, I will just repeat them. Okay, so I will give you just the solution for a point constraint. So k of z and x prime can be written as a constant times z over z squared plus the modulo of x minus x prime squared, everything to the delta. So you can convince yourself that it satisfies the boundary condition. If you multiply it with this one, spin goes to a delta function on the boundary, and that's because a coincident point, so if x is equal to x prime, this diverges at z goes to 0. But if x is different from x prime, this goes to 0 as z goes to 0. And and you can essentially fix your coefficient C delta such that it really reduces to a delta function. I'm sorry if this was a bit fast. I mean, you can just construct a bulk to boundary propagator in this way, just this form, such that it solves your equations of motion as a function of the boundary conditions. Okay. Would you have a few more minutes, or you all have to run? Because I have to decide how much I will need to skip of the computation. I don't know.
What else do you have?
So now this is the solution. Now you have to evaluate the action on shell. The action on shell diverges. So this is the usual divergences that you have in a field theory once you compute a correlation function. So you need to renormalize the action such that then you can safely take your action and take functional derivatives. So I guess another 15, 20 minutes maximum should be fine. Yeah. Okay.
Question, sorry.
Yes.
So the solution you wrote down for K, is that valid only near the, are you assuming that Z is small?
No. So given a bulk to boundary propagator, I can construct this for a boundary condition, I can construct a solution in the whole bulk. So this is a field phi. I mean, so in the picture of before, where this was the boundary, I'm specifying phi naught here, and then I'm using k to propagate my field into the bulk and to evaluate it at the point in the bulk.
Right, but I'm just wondering why does the bulk k does not depend on mass n? There's no mass n.
No, there is delta. So delta was fixed in terms of M. I've just replaced it by delta everywhere. Yeah. Okay. So I've erased the action, but you have it. So we can integrate by part the action. Should I do it, or you all know? No, okay. So if we integrate by parts the action, what we get is a term which is proportional to box minus m square phi plus a total derivative. So d mu phi. Okay. So when we say where we want to go on shell, this means we use the equations of motion. So this term evaluates to 0. And all we are left with is a total derivative. So our spacetime has a boundary in the z direction. So this total derivative will give a contribution in the z direction. So this will be, just removing one integral, maybe an integral in d dx, so now boundary coordinates of square root of g zz phi dz phi, which now we want to evaluate at z equal to infinity and at z equal to 0, so the extrema of the radial coordinate. But at z equal to infinity, which is the interior of the bulk, remember that we have solved for our fields phi, imposing that it's regular in the interior. So actually, these terms evaluate to zero by regularity. So the only thing that we're left with is a boundary term at z equals zero. So this is just minus 1/2, the integral of d dx evaluated at z equals zero of the square root of g, gzz, phi, dz, phi. Okay, but now we know how does our field scale at z equals zero. And we can do a power counting. So the square root of g times gzz in ADS is z to the minus d plus 1, if you just take the metric and evaluate it, while 2 powers of the field phi will go at z to the 2 d minus 2 delta. And then I've taken one derivative, so minus 1. So this is z to the d minus 2 delta. And remember that we were taking delta to be greater than d over 2. And so this blows up. So this integral is divergent near at z equals 0. So the way to treat this action, first of all, is to introduce a regulator. So we introduce a regulator epsilon. And so instead of evaluating our integral all the way to 0, we integrate all the way to z equal epsilon. And then eventually, at the end of our computation, we will like to be able to set epsilon to 0. Okay. Yes.
So, if I look at the massive Klein-Gordon equation, I would have thought that the solution should decay exponentially with z at large.
Right, so that's not the case in ADS. Okay. Well, a large z. Well, a large distances here means z going to 0.
No, I mean, I really mean not z going to 0, but at z much, much bigger than 1. I would think that's
what we did, right? So the regularity in the interiors was selecting the k-Bessel function with the k's exponential.
If I look at that equation, that cannot be true for all z, the equation you wrote there.
Which equation?
That k z x x prime. Is that true for all variables z, even z much bigger than 1?
Yes, that's any point in the bottom.
That doesn't exponentially decay.
It's not in one space.
Okay, so now we have our regulated action. So then we can plug in phi as we computed with the bulk boundary propagator. So this gives us, so I will just write it, dx1, dx2, phi naught of x1, phi naught of x2, times an integral of d dx, z, so this is at z equal to epsilon, z to the 1 minus d, k of z x, x prime, dz k of z x1, sorry, x2. Okay, so now for z going to 0, how does this bulk to boundary propagator behave? So we said it has a delta function. So k of zx, x prime, goes like z to the d minus delta times the delta function. And then it will have subleading contributions that go to zero on the boundary, starting from C delta Z to D delta over X minus X prime to the 2 delta, plus higher order in Z. So these higher order in Z, I'm not, just not writing them, because they will give terms which evaluate to zero once we remove the regulator epsilon. So then you can just plug this in and evaluate this on-shell action. And so let's just look at this term for simplicity. So this, as we just said, it will give us a term which goes like epsilon to the d minus 2 delta times the delta function, which, as we said, diverges. And then this product will also give us some finite terms. And I'm sorry, I have to skip a few steps, times d. So these are just mixed terms of delta functions times these ones in this product. OK, plus higher terms in epsilon. So this is a divergence. It's an infrared divergence from the bulk point of view. But it is an ultraviolet divergence from the field theory point of view, as it comes from very short distance behavior. So these are contact terms divergences. So who of you is familiar with renormalization theory? Okay. So this is like a standard procedure in field theory. And so the basic idea is that these divergences are actually not physical. And that one should actually somehow redefine the parameters of their theory as to match what can be measured in the experiments. And so the way to implement this is to actually, or one way to actually implement this procedure is to add to the action some counter terms. So we will add to S phi, another action, counter terms, such that the limit as epsilon goes to zero of this, that we will call the a renormalized action, is finite. So this counter terms action, it's constructed in a covariant way in terms of the fields of our theory, in such a way as to remove these divergences. So here, if you look at this divergent term, you see that this counter term action has to be of the form, has to be of the form d minus delta, which I forgot to write. Sorry, something important. Over 2 times an integral on d dx phi naught of x square. So it has to contain a square of the source. And such a term can be rewritten in a covariant way as d minus delta over 2. find the integrals of d dx, find the square root of h times phi of z and x square. And here this h is just the reduction of the bulk metric on the boundary. It's called the induced metric. So here it is simply, so hij is delta ij over z square, or actually for a boundary at epsilon over epsilon square. Okay, I mean, the details are not too important. It's just that so you can evaluate again this term by substituting the solution that we have in terms of the bulk to boundary propagator. This will contain a term of this form, which is constructed exactly in such a way as to cancel this divergence. But it will also contribute some finite terms. And so if you evaluate everything, what you find is that your renormalized action or better, the limit as epsilon goes to zero, so that I drop all these dots of my action is simply 1/2 d minus 2 lambda delta c delta times d dx1 d dx2 times phi naught of x1 phi naught of x2 over x1 minus x2 to the 2 delta. So essentially, it's these finite contributions that we had and just the coefficient that changes because you get the same finite contribution from this counter interaction. So this is the result of all this procedure. So the on-shell action that we wanted to evaluate at the beginning as a function of the boundary conditions for our bulk field phi is just this one. And so now what we can do is the following. So we can take functional derivatives with respect to the source and then set the source to zero. So to compute a two-point function, we take two functional derivatives and set the source to zero. So we find finally that OX1, OX2. So now computed holographically is, well, modulo all coefficients, which are just normalizations, is 1 over X1 minus X2 to the 2 delta. So we have exactly reproduced the conformal field theory result that you can obtain by much quicker considerations. Okay, was it more or less clear, the derivation? Okay. I just want to make two more comments. Yes.
So if you have a cubic interaction, there it would be phi zero cube term.
Exactly. So then you can take three functional derivatives and you will reproduce the three-point function that I wrote in the beginning. Yeah. You can try to do it. Yeah. You just have more powers of the propagators and of Z that you have to take into account. But yeah. Yes.
Even if you have like 5 to 4 interactions, then how two-point functions should always have this form?
Yeah. Because of the symmetry gradient. Yeah. So here we are in the vacuum. Then you can compute it in a thermal state. In your favorite Euclidean, asymptotically ADS geometry. So then it would be different.
If I compute three-point propagators on that.
Sorry?
So if I add cubic term on the computer, do they have this
formals here. Yes. Yes.
So if I add higher order terms, I'm like still.
Yeah, so you can add the cubic interaction.
The higher order is always
harder. Yeah. Okay, so another thing that we could have done, so here I've computed the two-point function. Another thing that we could have done was just to, so here I told you, so let's take functional derivatives and compute the correlator in the vacuum of the theory. We could have also computed the correlator not in the vacuum, but in the deformed theory, so leaving the source on. So by deformed theory, I mean just that we do not set phi naught to zero afterwards. So in that case, one can compute also a one-point function, which is otherwise zero in the presence of a source. So the modulo normalization again. X. Okay, so this will be a one-point function of the operator in the presence of the source. So it just means that we are turning on a source and we are propagating it and evaluating the expectation value of the dual operator at another position x.
Source is at x prime.
Sorry?
It's the source at x prime. Where's the source?
Phi naught of x prime.
Oh, so it's a profile. It's source is some field.
Yes. Okay. And then I just want to make two other comments. So one comment is that this whole procedure that we have seen in a specific example, in which you evaluate the Unschel action, the Unschel action has divergences, you regulate, you renormalize them by adding suitable counter terms, and then take your functional derivatives. So this whole procedure is just an example of a systematic way of dealing with this kind of computation, which goes under the name of holographic renormalization. Which is a procedure which allows you to essentially write down the most generic counterterm action that you would need to add to any asymptotically to any action evaluated on an asymptotically ADS solution, so with matrix, scalars, gauge fields turned on and coupled together, you can study what's the form of the divergences that you can emerge, and now you can actually treat them and renormalize, and from then compute correlators. And then the other comment that I want to make is that, so as in standard field theory, you use Feynman diagrams to represent diagrammatically scattering processes. Here, one can use what are called Witten diagrams to represent the computation of these three-level correlators in gravity. Okay, so you have seen well that I can also for think of ADS in global coordinates as a spacetime which has a cylinder as a boundary, just to make the drawing easier. So let me just move to global coordinates in which the boundary of ADS is a cylinder. And so then if you take a fixed time slice, you can just depict ADS as the interior of a circle, and the boundary of ADS is just the circle. So the computation that we have done here for the two-point function, so what we have done, we started with some operator O inserted on the boundary. This was sourcing a bulk field through a bulk to boundary to bulk propagator. And then we have taken the other point to the boundary, to another operator insertion. So this will be a diagram, a diagrammatic way to represent through this boundary to boundary propagator through the bulk the computation of the correlator that we have done. And one could do the same for a higher point correlator. So for instance, for three operator insertions, so we will need three bulk to boundary propagators that emanate from O. And then if we assume that our bulk action as a three-point interaction, for instance, they can meet at the vertex in the bulk. Is this clear? Or
how did the line split?
No, that's
in,
just...
In the other case, you have the point data, right? And in the three-point correlator case, what does it mean?
Here it means that here I have a three-point interaction. So for instance, I can have, so if this is a 1, or 2, and a 3, which serves respectively a field phi 1, phi 2, and phi 3, it means that my action contains a term of the type G, some coupling constant times phi 1, phi 2, phi 3. Okay? And so we can do...
Charge
of phi 1, phi 2, phi 3 is the trivial charge. Yes, so phi 1 and phi 2 can combine into phi 3. Yeah. That's what these interactions
are. Are these only suggesting that there are trajectories in APS that are being followed? Or
no, sorry. So here, this vertex, it's integrated over.
So in the previous case, when you had only the 2-point correlators, is there an iteration over possible trajectories? Or that's
in the end, this boundary to boundary propagator localizes on the boundary, as we have seen.
Well, maybe I missed that, but is there a geometric interpretation of a particular trajectory?
Yes, so
in the calculation, I missed that there was a particular trajectory that dominated the calculation, the result.
Yes, so in the end, the computation that we did just reduced
just a geodesic to connecting the two boundary points?
On the boundary, yes.
So there is a geodesic through the bulk?
Yes, no, it's completely localized on the boundary.
Okay.
Yeah.
Why is it
so this becomes a boundary-to-boundary propagator. So a boundary-to-boundary propagator does not go through the bulk. It just stays on the boundary.
And what's the meaning of drawing a line?
That's just a diagrammatic way of depicting it. I mean, the way that I was telling you is that I've computed O, and then this source is a field phi, and then as I take my field phi to the boundary, it's a propagator localizes on the boundary. Let me just draw the last drawing, because there is yet another ingredient which enters in this computation. So if we look, for instance, at a four-point function, so O1, O2, O3, and O4, so we can imagine, for instance, that we have a four-point interaction in the bulk. Well, we can imagine. I mean, it will be our UV completion theory of gravity that tells us what interactions we have. So for instance, we can have a diagram of this type. But we will also have contributions to this four-point function. For instance, if we again allow for three points as well of this type. And so you see that here we have yet another ingredient with enters, which is this type of propagator, which you also need to consider, which is a bulk to bulk propagator. So that just propagates your field phi in the bulk.
Our building blocks are back to boundary propagators and back to back propagators in order to make amplitudes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Or if you want, so a bulk to propagator, if you bring a one point to the boundary, reduces to a boundary to bulk, and then if you bring also the other point, it will be a boundary to boundary propagator. Yeah.
But
so you can start from this
one.
Yeah.
I mean, like in Feynman diagrams, we can have loops and everything, right?
So this is all at three level because we are working in the large n lambda much greater than one limits. If you want to introduce loop corrections, so one over n corrections, then you will also have loops. Yeah. Or if you want to introduce higher curvature corrections, then you will not anymore have a Tyrios semiclassical gravity, but you should. So you have two types of corrections here, as Mukund was explaining this morning. You can have loop corrections. So as you increase the coupling of your theory, loops may become more and more important. So these are just three level diagrams, but. If you do a 1 over n expansions, you will also have loops. Or you can have higher curvature corrections, which come not from considering just the Albert system, Einstein-Hilbert action, but some parent theory from which Einstein-Hilbert is just an effective theory at low energies. Okay, and yeah, that's all I wanted to tell you, and thank you very much for your patience.